Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Game Industry News Gen Lounge. Vince and I are here with a very special guest to talk about AI and animation. We have with us Mark Vange from NextPlay Technologies. How are you doing today, sir?
Great, sir. How are you?
We are doing well. So I know Vince is probably going to be asking most of the questions because he's more tech savvy than I am. But real quickly, if you could, Mark, just give us a brief introduction of who you are and what NextPlay is doing with animation.
Sure. So I've been in the video game industry for approximately ever since I sold my first little game at the age of 10 back in forever ago. And then my first real game was I helped create the Amiga version of Don Bluth's Dragon's Lair. And I've been, you know, in and out of games ever since. Yeah, so it's been a long time. And one of the cool things about Don Bluth's Dragon's Lair was, you know, there was a lot of animation, and we had to do a lot of manual work around kind of creating the animation and frame by frame, kind of encoding it, and then streaming it from floppies at the time, and so on. So, you know, I've been around this kind of whole game technology animation enablement for a very long time. I also built a company called VR1, which was the first kind of commercial publisher of MMOs around the world. We had the first commercial MMOs for Microsoft, for Sony, for other operators around the world. You know, I've done a bunch of other the companies in video games along the way. And let's see, 2007, 2008, I built a company called Mobile Post Production, which at the time was the largest mobile porting company. So effectively, we made games and apps run on every mobile phone in the world with every language and every billing operator and every, you know, all the weird bugs that phones had at the time and so on. And I ended up selling that company to Electronic Arts and became the chief technology officer at EA Interactive for a while. And so I've been in this video game business for a very long time. And one of the things that I have watched happen is obviously the production costs of games increasing and increasing and increasing. And so a tremendous amount of the cost of the creation of, you know, AAA titles, certainly these days, is in the art and in the animation. And we have, you know, amazingly talented people who are spending a lot of time and a lot of energy in creating all of this art. And it's kind of starting to overwhelm the cost of creating the titles to create all of these assets, and then more importantly, animate all of these assets to the kind of fidelity and to the level of realism that is expected, given the beauty and finesse of everything that these guys are building. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, as much as 70% of the cost of product is now being spent on the creation of the animation of this art assets. And, you know, so it becomes a very expensive undertaking to produce a AAA game or you know, like a mainline sports title or what have you, a lot of motion capture, a lot of, you know, blending and so on. And so as kind of more of an indie studio at the time, you know, that becomes a huge challenge to try and create games that have high production values, but that can still be developed for very niche markets. And I personally am a huge flight game guy. So we were working on a game at the time called Fighter Royale. And it's essentially a World War II game with airplanes. And we were creating essentially bots to try and fly against, because it's a Royale game and we needed enough airplanes in the air. And we started working on this AI system to essentially create these very believable pilots to fill the skies, and started actually kind of moving from there to actually creating self-motivating animation. And so this kind of comes back around to what we were actually building here, which effectively is the ability for characters that are built and rigged and described in physical terms, i.e., you know, in the physics of their movement, to then begin to manifest their own movement. So, you know, think about it as if I have, you know, a battle scene with thousands of characters and all of them are walking through the same walk cycle, right? It's going to look kind of silly. So I spent all this time on creating this beautiful scenery, you know, this very Kurosawa-like setting with, you know, thousands of warriors, and then they all kind of march in lockstep because, you know, that's the animation I've been able to afford. Well, when I have AI-generated animation for these objects, then suddenly each one can walk a little differently in response to the hills that he's stepping on, or the fact that he's stepping over, you know, the body of a fallen comrade, or whatever the environment that he's interacting with is. And so effectively what we're creating is a system that allows us to build the 3D object, build its skeleton, define its physical properties, and then give it a goal, you know, move from here to there, and then allow the neural net AI to actually generate all of the frames of that animation in real time to give us the most kind of realistic and accurate interpretation of that movement without spending, you know, 70% of the budget of the game on creating it.
That's actually incredible. And I have a ton of questions for you regarding that. And I hope you don't mind.
Not at all. Of course. That's why we're here.
So. So the way that you talk about it, it sounds like it's primarily for like background 3D model characters. You originally mentioned Dragon's Lair, which, I mean, that was an absolute tour de force in visual fidelity back then. I have a friend of mine who is such a huge fan of that game. He actually owns one of the keyframes from around the part where the princess is getting rescued from the very first one.
Sure.
But when you're mentioning like rigging 3D models and having them do their animations just slightly off so that way they all look mildly unique, is this primarily used to generate new animations from scratch? Is it used to modify existing animations that an animator may do just to take some of their workload off of them so they have more unique like walk cycles, things of that nature? Or does it do like, you know, all of the above, just a combination of both?
Right. So what we focus on is emergent behaviors. So essentially, there is something called adversarial training, which is, you know, I create a character, I create a walk cycle, and then the neural net tries to kind of match that walk cycle as closely as possible, given the fact that I'm going up a stair, right? That's not actually what we do. What we're focused on is what is emergent behavior, where we create sort of the physics, and then we just give our characters goals, like, you know, we want you to move from here to there, and then you go figure it out how to do it. And, you know, you spend a lot of time kind of second guessing how it's going to work around you initially. So, you know, the simplest example is you say, go from here to there, the character lies down and rolls. Because that's the simplest way for this physics to manifest, right? So then you say, okay, go from this point to that point while keeping your head, you know, between 5 and 6 feet off the ground, right? And so suddenly, you know, he goes backwards. So, you know, it's kind of a combination of having really good high quality models that allow natural motion to emerge, having really good physics engine that allows for that simulation to happen, and also the right set of kind of success criteria. But the behaviors are manifested entirely by this creature itself, by the character, whatever it is. And so it allows us a wider variety of, let's call it, animations. And so I'll give you two examples of why that's important, right? Having a human animation is cool enough, right? But like one of the things that we regularly work with is a model of a centipede, because nobody in their right mind is going to spend their hours animating, you know, the 100 legs of a centipede in order to get kind of real looking motion, because the payback is just too low. But actually, when you get it, it looks amazing, right? The other thing that we're focused on is even not kind of characters per se, but One of the things that NextPlay is focused on, one of our businesses is called HotPlay, which is essentially an in-game advertising platform. But rather than having kind of banners that are stuck into the environment or overlay ads or those sorts of, you know, kind of current generation ads, what we're focused on is essentially making objects that it can interact and be adapted into the environment. So just a simple example, you know, I'm running through a first-person shooter. I need to pick up the health potion. For me, that health potion might look like a Diet Coke. For you, it might look like an orange juice. I drink it and I get a coupon in my coupon wallet for 20 cents off a Diet Coke at 7-Eleven, right? But when we start putting cooler objects into the game environment, those objects suddenly need to be fungible in that they need to work in any game. So now we have a 3D object with its physics and animation that has to actually figure out the environment in which it's operating so that it can move around and kind of insert itself into the current environment given, you know, its gravity and its lighting and its everything. And so that's sort of the ultimate goal, is to be able to, in real time, create these entities that can literally be dropped into an environment and given what we call verbs and adjectives to operate in those environments.
I have a question. I know I saw something that I feel like this has also been kind of been used in film. I think I saw something on a Lord of the Rings movies for like the giant battle scenes. They had a couple of actors in there, but then they digitally multiplied the rest and have them using AI to act differently. Do you know if that, obviously it's not the same, but is that like a similar premise to what you're doing, but instead of film, just implementing it in video games?
So it is a similar thing. I don't specifically know whether what they were doing there was more kind of like training around motion capture to sort of try to reproduce the motion, or it was more emergent. I assume it was probably more motion capture based, but I don't actually know that for a fact. But you know, ultimately it's definitely related, which is, you know, we're trying to create motion kind of economically that looks realistic and is responsive to its environment. And you know, ideally in a way that is still artistically controllable for the creator of the game, or, you know, the animator, right? So, you know, when we talk about a walk, right, Conan walking is a different kind of a walk than the princess Daphne walking, right? So there's not only the verb to walk or to run, right, but there's also sort of like the adjective that describes stylistically that walk or that run. And so the ability to stylistically manipulate this motion is kind of what we're trying to create and to capture in a way that allows us to both reduce the cost and time involved in creating the content, but also then ultimately insert arbitrary objects into arbitrary environments and allow them to function inside those environments. And unlike in that film example where you get to do that kind of offline and get to spend as much computational time as you need to doing it, as you guys know, in video games, ultimately, we have to get this stuff running in real time somehow.
Yeah, and I find it especially interesting that this can be applied toward like various assets, because I know that gathering assets from other places like Unity, I know that Unreal has like their own store where you can pick up assets and then utilize them in your game at a later time. Having animations bundled with them, especially if the animations look great and they have like their own physics, they're able to be applied to different types of environments, that sort of thing, that could dramatically cut down on the amount of time that an indie developer would need in order to, I don't know, create a reactive environment in a game that they're trying to make. Would you foresee any particular issues with trying to use like an asset that was created by your software and incorporated into something else over time? Like would selling these be a portion of your revenue stream, I guess, would be the easier way to ask that.
Yeah. So yeah, no, absolutely. That is definitely in our plans, is to create, you know, these kind of libraries of objects, or at least libraries of kind of skeleton objects, which could then be decorated. The other way around is tougher because, it's not necessarily the case always that objects are created with sort of physics and skeletal veracity in mind, right? Sometimes objects are just created to look good. Whereas for us, in order for the physics to actually create the right emergent behavior, we need to have kind of the right skeletons and also the right musculature and so on, because otherwise the physics can't manifest the right behavior, if that makes sense. So that's one opportunity. The other opportunity is also to be able to, again, inject advertising content and advertising, you know, animated advertising content, if you will, into games. So, you know, the old, you know, if you guys know this reference, the old, you know, I'd walk a mile for a camel, you know, the old cowboy smokes a cigarette, right? I mean, that wasn't just a photo of a product. That was, you know, a character that was using the product. So imagine a world where I can take that motion and that animation and then apply it to the in-game character. So it might look like, you know, game A's character when it's happening in that game. It might look like game B's character happening in that game. But because we can sort of manipulate that character using our AI engine, we can essentially try to replicate that behavior even given a different set of musculature, which is sort of the same functionality but turned backwards, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. You'd be applying effectively the same animation across multiple characters of varying like mesh size and things like that.
Right.
Which is kind of fascinating in its own right. Because a lot of times you'll see games that will reuse animations on different characters, and they might be morphed in a relatively awkward way, I guess is how I'll put it.
Right. So, yeah, exactly. So, you know, ideally we'd be a little less awkward. But, you know, this is definitely kind of a crawl, walk, run type of problem. So, you know, where we're starting right now, as you kind of mentioned earlier, is more kind of background characters and those kinds of things, because, you know, there's a little bit more wiggle room for improvement in the animation of those kinds of secondary characters, you know, or zombies or robots, as opposed to kind of more like human characters where, you know, the level of realism is very sensitive to human perception.
I got a question going back to the advertising. You mentioned that you could say, I could go to pick up a health potion in a game and it could look like a Pepsi for me. It could look like a Mountain Dew for Vince or a Dr. Pepper for someone else. Because we're seeing advertising kind of growing a little bit more in games. Do you guys aim to keep it at least semi-subtle? And like by this, I'm mostly referring to, I don't know if you've heard about like NBA 2K21, where like the loading screens are like unskippable commercials, and
yeah, so
it's bad.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is exactly what I think everybody hates. I mean, the developers hate it, the players hate it, the publishers hate it. The only, you know, the advertisers that maybe don't even love it. It's just they need to get the impression, right? Our approach to advertising is quite different. And again, so we're focused more on the connection between physical goods and in-game advertising. So what we care more about, let's say, is getting you into the store to buy the product than necessarily, you know, doing the link to another game to install on your phone type of advertising. But we're definitely very focused on having these kind of positive interactions with the brand from a user's perspective. So, you know, again, if I am using a game mechanic that is already a part of the game, picking up the health potion, right? then when I drink that Dr. Pepper, I essentially have not interrupted my flow, but I have, you know, what you might think of as a positive brand impression, because I've now connected my Dr. Pepper with something good that I want in that game's outcome anyway. Or maybe, you know, I'm playing more of a high school social game, and I need to, you know, get the right, you know, brand of jeans to get, you know, more of my kind of social points. Or, you know, I need to acquire the right kind of car or whatever it is, right? And then we connect that interaction with redemption in our kind of, think of it as like a coupon redemption app or wallet. And so we're not interrupting your gameplay. We're giving you a positive interaction with that brand or product. And then we're giving you an opportunity to take advantage of the thing that you earned in the game when you're done playing. So, you know, the next time you happen to be at a 7-Eleven, you know, that coupon is in, is on your phone, then you can save a little money on your Diet Coke. And then, oh, by the way, you know, it's great, you can get 20 cents off your Diet Coke, but if you buy a six pack, you can get something cool back in the game, and sort of completing the retention loop that way. And that's kind of what we're focused on, is connecting real retail, let's say, with in-game advertising.
That's actually interesting, because it would wind up interrupting the player less and be more, I guess, subliminal in a way.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's subliminal so much as...
That's probably a bad word, yeah.
Yeah, don't go there. Yeah, no. But, I mean, it's definitely... The goal is to drive commerce, obviously, right? I mean, that's the fundamentals of advertising. But to do it in such a way that is a positive experience for the user, doesn't interrupt their game, but actually also creates more monetization opportunities for the publisher or the developer, because actually the value of that interaction that results in actual physical spend at the store is much higher than like a CPM type rate for an impression, and is also a much more reliable measure of that success from the advertiser's perspective, which is why it's much more valuable.
I know I appreciate it more than some of the limited edition things that I've seen, like when Final Fantasy VII Remake came out, how they wanted you to buy upwards of like 20 or 30 Butterfingers or Twix bars or something, but to get be able to redeem limited edition items. I appreciate kind of how this is more, hey, if you're going to go out and you get this stuff, you can just come back and get something else. It's not, hey, we know you want this cool thing, but we want you to go out first and buy a whole like 32 candy bars to get one of 500 digital things on there. So I kind of like how it's a more organic transaction than some of these other ad campaigns of the past.
It's yeah, better than Final Fantasy XV's cup noodle too.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're all exploring ways to monetize, and we're, you know, given that ultimately we are all operating largely in this kind of freemium environment, or at least kind of induced spend environment, we're all trying to find ways to connect real players with real retailers. You know, there's a lot of issues that need to be resolved. The fraud issue is a huge one, which kind of undermines the rates that everybody is willing to pay and therefore receives at the end of the day. And so what our approach focuses on is A, creating a more positive experience for the user, but also B, providing a more reliable experience for the advertiser, so they're less concerned about fraud levels and therefore can, you know, generate more value from their spend. So we think we kind of have a better way to build that what is ultimately, you know, financial connection between the player and the retailer.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense to me. Would you happen to have any particular games that the technology your company's worked on has been utilized in yet. I don't know if it's actually been like loaded into something where people could like see an example of it, just like in the case they were skeptical, interested, what have you.
Sure. So we have done a few kind of pilot launches. They were all done in Thailand, actually, which may make it a little bit trickier for people to have seen it. We are a company with a footprint in Bangkok. We have a studio there, and one of our headquarters of the Hot Play unit is there, and that's kind of where this technology was built and originated. So we did do some testing with some retailers there, and we had actually really good redemption rates, but you know, all of those campaigns are now behind us, and we're kind of finalizing the productization and kind of going out into the real world with this business. And, you know, because we're connecting with the kind of real world retail, it's kind of one step more complicated than selling to more of a digital advertiser. You know, as you guys probably are aware, ultimately, all retail is local, right? There's no such thing as Coca-Cola advertising worldwide. Each country, or in some cases, the region in a country, has their own distributor that has the, you know, the local license, that probably runs the local advertising campaigns and, you know, gets approvals from headquarters, but actually writes the business for their local markets. And so part of our challenge as a company has been to actually build that sales infrastructure and that sales pipeline to be able to create the relationships. You know, when I kind of in a very arm waving way say, well, and you get a coupon to save 20 cents on a Diet Coke at 7-Eleven, you know, that's actually a really complicated thing to do. It's actually not that simple to get 7-Eleven on board and get Coke on board and, you know, do that in each country or each province or territory or whatever. And so that's kind of what we're in the process of doing now, is we are building that whole network and kind of approaching it one market at a time. And a part of the way that we have done that is we acquired the majority of a company called Zapware, which is a provider of TV, kind of interactive TV infrastructure around the world. And so we essentially go hand in hand with the cable operators who are already in the business of selling advertising for linear content, you know, for TV, and, you know, working with those guys to open up each market to be able to offer these kinds of, you know, essentially couponing back into the store into video games. And so there's a lot of moving parts, and that's what we're kind of assembling right now is the practical kind of business reality of that, now that we've shifting from proof of concept in the one market where we happen to have a lot of leverage through our partnerships to you know, more markets more broadly.
So I always hate to ask this question. I always feel dirty, but hypothetically, if you had, and these questions never age well, if you had to guesstimate, how long do you think it would be before we start seeing this sort of technology in games like Pokemon, Call of Duty, Battlefield? Like, what this technology that is being developed by your company, how quickly do you think it'll be actually deployed widespread, other than a few niche titles?
So actually, I think that it's going to be a while before we see it in flagship titles, actually. I think that, and our strategy is to focus more on casual games, on games that get developed quickly, on games that don't necessarily have the, you know, let's say, so much to lose if it's not, you know, exactly right. And kind of go from there. You know, there is, as you know, casual games, kind of quick turn games, indie games, have a much faster pace of evolution and a much quicker pace of invention when it comes to this stuff. And so we're actually more focused on kind of more casual games that tend to also overlap better with retail consumers that tend to skew more female, maybe a little bit older, less about actually first-person shooters and more about, you know, clickers and, you know, mini sims and collection games and these sorts of things. So I guess that's a long way of saying that, I don't think that we're going to necessarily see this in a AAA title in 2022, but we'll see this in like casual games and more generally approachable games in 2022.
That's soon too. So that's actually, that's a very good claim to make. Because people might start seeing these more often and just games maybe they play while, you know, waiting on the commute to work, or maybe that their children are playing, like maybe a cute little character who bobs up and down behind a store shelf, you know, for one of those like buying purchasing games like Wreck-A-Tier or something might be using this technology in the future. Who knows?
I mean, you know, in our pilots, in our little experiments, you know, we've done all sorts of things, including, you know, all the way to, you know, ordering food to be delivered, you know, to your house while you play from inside of the game, right? Like, I mean, we've done all sorts of cool stuff with, again, kind of local partnerships in pilot type form. But now, you know, the transition to the real world at scale is kind of the thing that we're undertaking.
And licensing itself can be a huge hurdle to overcome, even if you're a giant company with a massive pedigree. Neil and I were just talking about Super Smash Brothers last night, and like Nintendo is one of the biggest companies in the world. And from what I understand, they still had to jump through a million hoops in order to secure a lot of those third-party characters that people really wanted to be part of this one singular game. So, you know, not relatively new company, but a company that's not like, that doesn't have that kind of global market share yet, trying to make all of those deals, it must be kind of nightmarish.
Well, so I mean, we definitely focus on partnerships. As I said, our kind of go-to-market strategy is on, you know, on the advertiser side is to partner with the cable operators in each market because they already have a sales force that calls on these sorts of advertisers. And then on the game developer side, you know, we're definitely looking for developers and publishers to work with. But we are, you know, a part of their mix of advertising solutions as opposed to their only one, because we will have to open the world kind of one market at a time. And, you know, some of the operators that we'll end up working with would be, you know, in large markets, let's say Germany or Austria, right? And another one may be, you know, Mongolia or, you know, some much smaller market in the Caribbean or whatever. But each market needs to be opened one at a time. And that's kind of where we're focused is creating those relationships and opening up more and more opportunities for this sort of monetization through one sort of common fungible SDK that allows us to take, you know, the product, the brand, and so on for each market and insert it into these games in a relevant way. And, you know, that involves some location-based understanding of who the player is. That involves inferential data on the demographics. And, you know, as you guys know, there's been a lot of changes in that space as well in terms of what we're allowed to do and the kind of data that we're allowed to utilize for those inferences. And so, yeah, there's a lot of moving parts, certainly to making this happen.
This has been a great, a really great talk. Do you have anything else, Vincent?
No, he answered all of my questions. Great. It's an interesting concept for a technology. I think it'll be neat to see it get used in the future. because I'm not exactly the greatest animator in the world myself. I might even try using it to like help animate background characters in a future project. Who knows?
So yeah, I was gonna say at this point, floor is open to you. Anything that we've missed or that you think the listeners should hear about, by all means, floor is yours.
Thank you. No, I was just going to say we covered an awful lot of territory. We started off on the, you know, kind of very geeky, very technical side with the whole kind of animation AI system, and then we ended up talking about the mechanics and kind of the business model of the advertising business where that animation is going to be used in part. So covered a lot of ground very quickly. So hopefully we didn't give anybody whiplash. But it's been a pleasure, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
And thank you so much for coming on.
And with that, I guess this is the end of this episode, guys. Thank you for joining us. And again, always make sure that you share with your friends and get your people that you like or maybe even dislike to listen to us. We'll hopefully have more interviews in the future. So, Mr. Vange, thank you for showing up this week.
My pleasure. Again, thanks for having me.